Welcome back to Red Flags Rising. My name is Mike Heineke. I'm the co-chair of Hughes, Hubbard & Reed's Sanctions, Export Controls, and AML Practice. With me, as always, is my great friend Brent Carlson, a director at the Berkeley Research Group. It is Thursday, July 31st, 2025, just after 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. Brent, how are you doing today?
Excellent, Mike. Every day is a great day here at Red Flags Rising.
Well, we had really the first significant corporate enforcement action on a high probability theory of enforcement announced earlier this week on Monday, July 28th, 2025. Brent, it's been a busy 7 to 10 days. We had the AI action plan announced last week. We spoke about that on our last pod. I don't think we were expecting there to be right on the heels of that, this settlement agreement. What I thought was particularly interesting, just stepping back and looking at what's going on in the world, is there's a lot of speculation that export controls are really going to be on the negotiating table and really fair game as part of the discussions between the United States and China. The Department of Justice and the Department of Commerce came out with this announcement, and this is a big one. This is not a dog of a case like you had characterized some earlier ones, but more of a lion, Brent, with $140 million combined in penalties and forfeiture. $95 million of that is attributable to the BIS civil settlement itself. So this is the largest standalone BIS penalty amount since April of 2023, when there was a $300 million civil penalty imposed against Seagate. Frankly, Brent, this is something that many within the Commerce Department have been previewing for a long time. This was one that was meant to be noticed and has lots of lessons learned to unpack in it. Brent, there was a lot of focus on Commerce Department enforcement by the Senate's Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, in particular the majority staff, had issued a report on December 18th, 2024. What did that report call for?
The Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, in their December report, had criticized BIS for not leveraging the full definition of knowledge under the Export Administration Regulations, which includes not just actual knowledge, but an awareness of a high probability. The Senate majority staff were criticizing BIS for not bringing cases like it, which leverage that full definition of knowledge, which turns on that awareness of a high probability.
Absolutely, Brent. This is a high probability case through and through. Throughout the document, the Bureau of Industry and Security and its summary of the facts emphasized that the company involved or its employees were acting not with actual knowledge, but with, as BIS ultimately, I think, described it multiple times, reason to know, including an awareness of a high probability. Now, there was that earlier settlement back in August of 2024 for a much smaller amount. That turns out really to be a precursor to something like this.
It may be helpful to talk about what that means a bit. So, like, turning on that full definition of knowledge, which includes an awareness of a high probability. In this particular case, there was an entity-listed customer, an end user. Then sales were made through two front companies, essentially, at the end of the day. So when we talk about this awareness of a high probability, I think everybody knows if you've got an entity listed customer out there or potential customer out there, you can't sell to them without applying for a license. That's a no-brainer. Where this awareness of a high probability comes in is, okay, are there red flags that indicate that there's another entity that may be serving as a front company or a shell company that's diverting to an entity listed company or anybody else on a denied party list? That's the key issue. And that's really where the juice is. That's really where BIS and DOJ, National Security Division, have picked up on this, where they go, okay, that's where the risks are in terms of potential diversion of these sensitive dual use technologies. In this case, and in that earlier one from last August, but especially in this case, the government is saying we are focusing our enforcement efforts on these type of issues. We all know you shouldn't have any entity list customers that you're selling to without a license, but you shouldn't be going through front companies as well without having resolved red flags around those transactions. That's the important thing to look at. I mean, it's not the old days of, well, okay, we got a customer, they go on the entity list, and then we're just going to ship it to somebody else. Those are over. That's a key takeaway from this case. The government saying that that's their focus for enforcement, and their expectations for companies' compliance programs are to be able to prevent these as well.
Brent, this underscores a point you and I have been making over and over again. The objective of national security-based laws in the United States, especially national security-based laws that regulate global trade, that regulate economic activity, is not to see who can come up with the most creative Hong Kong accountant or the most clever offshore structure. It's not an exercise in form over substance. It is substance over form. you can disagree maybe with some of the national security justifications offered, but it's not for the private sector to decide what the national security issues are. The government decides. And if you think you have different information, if you disagree with them, engage in that debate with them, engage in that dialogue. But when they've imposed controls for national security reasons, and here, for example, we have the government asserting that the entities involved were tied to the Chinese nuclear program, that has to be taken as a given. That can't really be just dismissed as boilerplate. And there's no allegation that that was dismissed as boilerplate here. But the broader lesson is that in that space, it is not just form over substance. It is not just finding the front company. It is not, in particular, just transferring IP and equipment from one company to another as the government tries to catch up by listing these various entities. That's where, Brent, the real involvement from the U.S. parent side comes later in transferring some IP rights and some contracts from one front company to another. It doesn't mean that they knew that those were front companies. Actually, the whole basis of this enforcement action is that they didn't have actual knowledge. But it's just that they did that while having reason to know, including an awareness of a high probability, and failed to do the due diligence to bottom that out. Brent, when I look at the facts, they fall into two main buckets. There's one bucket of facts that relate to actions really taken by the local China subsidiary and Chinese customers that look in the real world, trade compliance people sitting back at the U.S. parent company are not going to easily be able to detect in real time. Then there's a second set of allegations that relate to red flags that were raised to the attention of the U.S. parent that really, once all this stuff then gets lumped together under the collective knowledge doctrine, is why you see all these facts here being admitted to by the corporate parent. But why don't we start, Brent, with China? What were some of the key aspects of that?
Well, basically, you had a university in China that was connected with the People's Liberation Army. So this was the National University of Defense Technology. That was the entity that was on the entity list starting from 2015. And there was another company in China, the Central South CAD Center, CSCC, which had connections to the National University of Defense Technology, NUDT. These connections were shared individuals, shared people. The local sales team in China, they knew this. They knew the connection, and you had them in their communications referring to these as one entity. Interestingly, and I've seen this before, hiding behind the language, they would put CSCC slash, then the Chinese characters for the National University of Defense Technology. From a language perspective, it stands out like a sore thumb. In Chinese, it says NUDT. Individuals at Cadence were selling these design software products to CSCC that were going and being installed in NUDT facilities.
It wasn't only the sales team that knew that these were really the same people, or that there was a fuzzy line, to say the least, between CSCC and NUDT, but you also had technical personnel on site installing some of the equipment, and they knew and were commenting on that they were on a military installation and that they were installing the equipment not at CSCC, but at NUDT.
When Cadence Design's compliance folks put a hold on them, another entity came up, and the contracts from CSCC were then assigned to this Fidium, but Fidium had red flags of having connections to NUDT as well.
Brent, we've talked about dynamic and holistic assessments of risk. This is actually a very good example of that. And frankly, of the exact right response to that, there was a change in regulation, specifically to a catch-all provision related to military end uses or military end users. This prompted a review because the catch-all provision was amended to not only focus on specific end users, but to support or services being provided to those end users. They very appropriately double-checked, are there any instances where we might be doing that type of conduct that required them to think about, well, who are the customers? Who are the end users? In September 2020, they took action to terminate CSCC as a customer. Where the headquarters then got maybe wrapped around the axle a bit is in that transition. This is exactly what we've been talking about in terms of identifying those real, those most significant export controls compliance risks. It's the change. It's the new customer. It's the new relationship. Up to that point, a lot of the facts look like they were very localized. After that point, then you have the involvement of other people in facilitating that transition of intellectual property, of hardware, of contracts from CSCC to FITM. The admitted facts in the settlement agreement talk about people reminding people that the new points of contact need to have email addresses with domain names that reflect the new entity we're doing business with. BIS took that to be a suggestion that that was more form over substance. The discussion of what red flags were visible to employees at the U.S. parent comes under a heading in the settlement agreement, agreed facts, that the personnel knew about information associated with CSCC that should have prompted further due diligence. Now, why do they say further due diligence? Well, because at some point there was some additional due diligence done, including requesting a letter of assurance in January of 2019 to confirm that there was no prohibited end use and or end user involved in those transactions. Well, they signed it, but this goes back to a point we've also been making a few times that, well, certainly as a baseline, when you're talking about tens of thousands of customers, hundreds of thousands of customers, you're going to have to rely for a large percentage of those on self-certification in order to handle risk. But where you start to become aware of red flags, those aren't going to protect you. Here, for example, we saw that a vice president was talking to people about making sure that points of contact were using email addresses associated with a second front company after CSCC was blocked. So if you look at the statement of facts in the criminal plea agreement signed with the Department of Justice's National Security Division, the company sought and received from FITM confirmation that its products were not military items, were not used to support a military item, and were not used to support or contribute to the operation, installation, repair, refurbishing, development, or production of a military item. FITM readily confirmed this.
FITM's the fabulous chip designer. Right? The plea agreement and the settlement agreement noted that through open source documents, FITM was designing chips for NUDT's supercomputer.
While those certifications are the baseline, while they're expected, they are not mitigating once you're confronted with red flags like we saw in this case. Just getting a second end-use certificate or getting an end-use certificate from a different company doesn't help. Around this time, a customer didn't pay their bills on time, so there was a discussion about credit concerns.
This is a good example of looking at things holistically across the company. The finance team, they're doing their jobs. CSCC was a customer that was delinquent on payment, so it became a credit risk. The finance team at corporate then looked at it and they go, okay, well, we can't find any credit reports on this company. We can't find sufficient background on it where they would have the wherewithal to be able to buy our products. Then the finance team, looking at it from their own perspective, said, okay, based on payment history, we're going to let this go forward with some conditions. One of the lessons learned out of this is that if you're in the enterprise and you see some of these red flags that pop up, raise them with the compliance team as well, because that's a classic red flag that BIS has put out in its guidance. It's really important for that due diligence process to take a holistic and qualitative approach and look at what could be some issues here, what could be some red flags where you don't want to just skip those over. You want to be able to identify them and address them, because if it comes out in an investigation down the road, BIS comes out with an outreach visit or they come out with an administrative subpoena, you don't want to get caught flat-footed. Penalties in this case are $140 million. On the civil side from BIS is $95 million. DOJ gave a 20% reduction on the penalty for partial cooperation. But on the BIS side, there was a maximum penalty allowed, which is twice the value of the transactions. They got an administrative subpoena. And once that comes in, you lose voluntary disclosure credit. For companies, if you're starting to get outreach visits, they're asking questions and then you're responding to them and you're taking proactive views out of your own compliance program and addressing the specific questions that BIS is asking in these outreach visits, and you get a sense that there could be a risk of an administrative subpoena to follow. Well, then maybe you want to come on and disclose that first. So then you can get some of that credit, because twice the value of transactions can add up fairly quickly. BIS is being proactive in identifying these entities that pose diversion risk. That's part of the outreach program. They'll talk with companies. Are you doing business with them? They've got commercially available data sets so they can see trade flows. Hey, we show that you guys are doing business with this company. Can you tell us about your due diligence you did on that? Tell us about your KYC. Tell us about any red flags you identified. What did you do to address them? What did you do to resolve them? BIS has a lot more information, is a lot more proactive than they ever used to be. This goes back to our earlier FreshLooks article on how to avoid kicking the hornet's nest. If you're starting to get questions in an outreach visit, that look like they're teeing up an administrative subpoena, that's time to really have your spidey sense, have your radar on, get in front of it. If you do really evaluate those risks internally and see you have potential compliance exposure, get in front of it before the administrative subpoena comes. So you avoid kicking that hornet's nest, address it, nip it in the bud, get your credit with BIS first. If you do get hit with the administrative subpoena, then cooperate fully. Because at the end of the day, it's going to come down to a deal. That negotiation is going to determine where that penalty is going to fall in the future. What's going to be critical for success is not just following the BIS's Export Compliance Guidelines book, which we have right here, you know, which was last updated in 2017, but it's also incorporating that latest guidance from BIS that has emphasized this full definition of knowledge, that awareness of a high probability. What's a practical example? Know your customer KYC screening. It's not just who's going to be on an entity list or an SDN list. It's going to be, okay, when you had a customer that went on the entity list, then what happened? Did another entity just show up out of the blue? Did that entity have any credit reports on it? Does it look like it had the financial wherewithal to buy our company's products? That's the kind of thing they're going to be looking for in these audits. That's the signal that the government is sending through this case.
Signaling through settlement agreements and guidance has been criticized sometimes as prosecutorial common law, but it's very much the reality of FCPA enforcement, the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, with significant consequences, because this is a preview into the mind of BIS, into the mind of the National Security Division at DOJ, but what they think red flags look like and how they expect people to respond. They also expect people to read this. They expect companies to be familiar with this settlement, both the DOJ settlement and the BIS settlement, and they will constantly be pointing back to this settlement in the future for what they consider high probability to be. It's not scientific. That's one of the biggest challenges about it. It's not something where you can say, well, it's 68.3% probable, and so that's just below a 68.5% high probability threshold, right? The government's going to say things like, look, in this case we just put out where a company admitted to the facts and they paid $140 million, XYZ facts constituted a high probability. Brent, General Prohibition 10 had been previewed by the U.S. government back in May 2025 as an area of focus. Here we see it applied specifically in the situation where in that transfer from the first front company to the second front company, General Prohibition 10 caught that because it prohibits a broad variety of activities, financing, transfer, use, sale, with knowledge of not only a potential violation in the moment, but a prior violation of the Export Administration Regulations or a future one. Because BIS established that there was knowledge defined to include reason to know, including an awareness of a high probability regarding the first front company, that transfer to a second front company triggered General Prohibition 10. In addition to General Prohibition 10, Brent, it's worth highlighting something about the inchoate, the not yet fully formed offenses that we've talked about, aiding and abetting, misrepresentation, conspiracy. Here we have attempt. The BIS settlement agreement talks about preparation by the company of an agreement to transfer certain hardware to the second front company. That transfer never took place, but that preparation of the agreement itself, BIS highlights here as an attempted violation of the EAR, which is also prohibited under 764.2. That's BIS previewing that that's something they are focused on and that they are looking for. And if they see it, they will charge.
The key takeaways are high probability enforcement is here. Expect a lot more to come. This is just the tip of the iceberg in terms of what's coming down the pike. So we expect we're going to see a lot more enforcement cases turning on the full definition of knowledge that includes an awareness of a high probability. We're going to see, we expect BIS in its outreach visits and its administrative subpoenas to be looking for that sort of thing. So now is the opportunity for companies to get in front of that. Don't party like this is 1999. It's not 1999 anymore. Hey, man, it's 2025 and it's an entirely different world. Doesn't mean you have to shut off the business. Doesn't mean you have to go like run away. But just understand how the game has changed and play it in the right way.
Well, Brent, on the heels of this significant $140 million settlement that really was based on reason to know, including an awareness of a high probability, what's your managing up segment for this episode?
This is a quote from the economist Rüdiger Dornbusch, who said, Things take longer to happen than you think they will, and then they happen faster than you thought they could. Let me repeat that again, just because it can sound a little confusing. Things take longer to happen than you think they will. So they take longer to come than what you think they will, but then they happen faster than you thought they could. So when it unfolds very quickly. The point in this is that BIS has been previewing and signaling high probability enforcement for some time now. We've talked and written about this. It's now here. It's fully here with this case. This is not going to be a one and done. This is not the only case. This is not going to be something that's just, okay, that's it, move on. More cases are going to turn on this full definition of knowledge. So high probability enforcement and compliance is here.
Well, Brent, that concludes this episode of Red Flags Rising. Be well.
Thanks, Mike. Be well.